Hi, this is Melissa Manchester, and you are listening to Life Minute, you lucky people.
Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Melissa Manchester's voice and music have touched generations. From her original hits to Oscar-nominated movie themes and iconic collaborations, her career has been nothing short of legendary. Recently, she starred in the national tour of Funny Girl as Mrs. Bryce, earning critical acclaim, and made her debut as a classical composer with Awake, her first concerto for piano and orchestra. Her latest album, Review, features duets with some of her famous friends on previously unreleased songs, as well as fresh takes on several of her classic hits. She joined us in studio to tell us all about it. This is a Life Minute with Melissa Manchester.
It's been a wonderful, busy time. I just finished a wonderful run at 54 Below, and I just finished the premiere of a concerto that I composed July 19th at the Corning Museum. During COVID, I was scrolling through, watching whatever, and one day I saw just the hands of the pianist playing on his piano. I couldn't see him. And then he leaned over when he was done and explained the name of the piece and what it was about. And his name was Jeffrey Beagle. And I started to watch his salons that he was sharing. And I put a comment in and he responded. He said, "Are you the singer?" I said, "I am." And we started a conversation. And then a few months later, I was backstage getting my makeup ready for a concert. And he said, "Would you consider composing a concerto for piano and orchestra?" And I thought, would I? And I said, yes. And it took me about a month to write it. It's about 15 minutes long, and it's 5 movements, and it's called Awake. And I submitted it to him 4 days before I started rehearsals on Funny Girl for the national tour, which just ended last April.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade.
The first national tour of Funny Girl was very important to me personally because I had seen Barbara Streisand on Broadway when I was a young girl in 1964, and that role of Fanny Bryce made her a star. And I knew the music by the great Julie Stein, lyrics by Bob Merrill, and they had tried to do a national tour before over the years, and it just never happened. And when it was announced that this was actually going to happen, I said to my manager, "I just need to audition. I just need to at least try to audition for the role of Rose Bryce, her mother." I went to the audition. I was prepared, and it was on Broadway. Lea Michele had taken over the role, and Tova Felcher was playing Rose Bryce, and then my manager forwarded the email that said, "We would love you to be part of the national tour." And I had just become a grandma for the first time. And I thought, ugh, missing all those firsts in that first year, I don't know. So I checked in with my kids and they all said, you have to go on this adventure. We will make this work. And indeed we did, through the miracle of FaceTime. We played 556 performances in 51 cities. It was just the greatest adventure I'd ever been on. It was incredible to be part of this beautiful village, this exquisite production, and it was so interesting how it resonated with audiences. I mean, most people never saw it on Broadway, and children loved this show. 9-year-olds just loved the story of this woman's triumphant will, and the company was happy and talented and excited to be there, and it was just a spectacular experience, really. In the midst of all of that, while I was on the road, my 25th album, Review, was released, and I couldn't really support it. I was doing 8 shows a week, but it was released to wonderful reviews, thankfully. So now I'm out and about performing in support of that. Review is really a thank you to the fans. It is the re-recording of several of my charted hits with certain harmonic tweaks, with no fade endings. They all come to an end, because that's what you do on stage. Things come to an end. And I really love that about implementing that per song because it made sense. And the song has a beginning, middle, and an end. We have one new track on there of a very old song of mine that I'd never recorded before called Confide in Me.
Confide in me. Rely on me.
I wrote it with Stan Schwartz many years ago. It had been recorded by Diana Ross, and Raquel Welch sang it to a Muppet on The Muppet Show, but I'd never recorded it. So I finally found the samba pocket that I really wanted it to live in. And we did a beautiful video of it, and it ended up being my most viewed video. But also, I re-recorded my first hit, Midnight Blue, in duet with Dolly Parton.
Midnight Blue.
She's a queen. She deserves to be a queen. People pull their cars over in Nashville and yell her name. You know, they just, there was a scene in the video that towards the very end where we filmed this in Nashville, and we just drove out of the parking lot, made a right and a right and a right and a right down around the block. And there happened to have been a tour bus as we were driving down one of the streets. And when the people saw her, they just start to drip out of the side of the bus, screaming her name. She's charming and brilliantly talented and just the smartest person in the room. She's just incredible. And I finally did record the song I wrote with Kenny Loggins, Whenever I Call You Friend. We recorded that. We'd been trying to record together for about 45 years. It didn't work out over the years because of scheduling bumps or budgetary concerns. And with Review, I thought, you know, I'm just going to put this album together. If he can be part of it, that's great. And if he can't, that's fine too. But I wanted to create a new take on the song because the song is so solid, but I didn't want to recreate his version of the hit he had with Stevie Nicks. It's a very layered track, lots of vocals and stuff like that. Some of the chords have been changed. And I sent the track with my working vocal. He said, I'm in, this is fantastic. I'm based in LA and he's up in Santa Barbara, so we drove up there and recorded his vocal performance, which is such a specific sound. I mean, his voice is just remarkable. And we filmed the video up at his studio, and it was just joyful. He was so happy with this chapter of the song, this iteration. So it was really, really lovely. And I'm told that he's including a clip of my version of our song in his documentary, which is really nice.
Do we remember who we are?
I wrote that while I was on the road with Funny Girl, and I had no access to a keyboard. You know, I was just in my hotel room. So I kept beating it out on my thighs as the words and the melody came to me. I wrote it in response to the election that was about to take place. And it was an idea that I had read about in literature in a couple of different books, the idea of you will know what your answer is when you remember who you are. And I thought, that's such a powerful concept to me. And I wanted to sort of answer my call to this moment because we are in the midst of a deep history that's unfolding. And so I wrote the song, and I had about 5 days off in between two legs of the tour and went into the studio and recorded it and put the voices on it, and we had a very talented videographer put the video together to really respond to the moment and the squeeze of what we are on trial to get through. And I was very honored that Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi used the song to display all of the women in the House and in Congress and in the Senate. So that was thrilling. It speaks across party lines. I mean, that's my intention. And it is literally about remembering who we are as a nation. and the freedoms we hold dear that have been fought for. And the sound of rusting hands going backwards are those evildoers who are trying to rescind rights that have been fought for. So that's what I can do, is to write, you know, capture a moment. I glibly refer to my mind as my pet, so it's always sniffing around for inspiration. And I know how my mind works at this point. It took me a while, but I know it just sort of, if something is interesting, and then it just sort of glums on, you know, a dog with a bone. When that happens and my curiosity sort of bites into an idea, what is happening is that an idea is insisting on being expressed. I just have to find the language and the setting, the musical setting, to best express it. What I know to be true is that language sings, and you have to sort of get out of the way of it so it can inform you the tune it is singing. And I have the demo on my phone of when I first wrote Till We Remember Who We Are, and you hear me banging away on my thighs, and you hear the melody as it was showing up, and it was really interesting. I try to write away from the piano, because what happens is your body memory will get your fingers to play chords from the last three songs you wrote. And what I want to do is make sure that the melody is intact first, so that what I'm accompanying is new. I hadn't written a lot because I was busy, you know, doing my shows and working on my character and all that. But when this crept up in me, I just made a pot of coffee, stayed in my pajamas, and just let it show up. Yeah. I was raised in a very creative family. My mother was a pioneer in the fashion business. She was one of the first women to own her own design and manufacturing firm, Ruth Manchester Limited. She's actually in the New York Public Library, under Who's Who. And my father was a bassoonist with the Metropolitan Opera for many years. And so my sister and I were raised by two black sheep. The message we got was, go for it, you know, follow your curiosity. Which I think is important because, you know, a lot of times kids are given the message, follow your passion. Well, you don't really know what your passion is, but you can follow your curiosity, and that will lead you to a passion if it sticks. And so being raised in the Bronx and in Manhattan, it was the perfect place for me to have unbelievable adventures as a teenager. The New York Department of Parks was very active with teenage theater workshops at the time to keep us busy during the summer. I was in street theater. I was a gopher during the first season of Sesame Street at the Children's Television Network. I parked cars for a little theater company on the East Side. They didn't ask me if I knew how to drive, and I thought it best not to offer that I did not. But nobody got hurt, and that's the important part. I was a jingle singer, so I made a really good living, and I was able to pay for the demos that I was constantly sending to record companies, and I was being constantly rejected. It took me 7 years. But I met Barry Manilow along the way, and I met Bette Midler, and eventually I became a harlot for Bette, and I worked for her for about 6 months. And then I put out my first record, I think, in 1973. I studied songwriting with Paul Simon. When I was 17, I'd gone to NYU School of the Arts on East 7th Street for 1 year, and my acting teacher was Olympia Dukakis. She was fantastic. The school was nutty, but she was just incredible. And she wanted me to return at the end of that 1 year, and I said, oh no, you'll do fine without me. And I went back to work singing jingles. But I had two friends, the playwright Jeff Sweet and our other friend Brett Mitchell, who stayed at NYU. And they called me one day because they were young songwriters. And in those days, this is long before social media, so there was just a scrap of paper on the bulletin board that said, songwriting taught by Paul Simon. And we thought, what would he be doing on 7th Street? Bridge Over Troubled Waters is number one all over the planet. And it was indeed Paul Simon of Simon & Garfunkel at the time. And he auditioned everybody. He chose 10 of the most disparate types of young songwriters. We studied with him for about 6 months. It was a very simple class, 2 hours a week. You had to come in with an idea or a verse or a finished song, including him. And he would talk about his experience as a songwriter and what it's like to be on tour and what it's like to be in competition with the Beatles, for instance. The nugget of what he taught really is that all of the stories have been told. It's the way you tell the story that's what separates you out. It's the way you use language. It's the way you use metaphors. It's the rhythmic quirks that make something interesting and pop that will separate you out. And it was invaluable and true. It remains true to this day. I created the character of Maddie Russo on the series Blossom when Mayim Bialik was a young teenage girl, and I knew at that point how brilliant she was. I mean, she was raised really well. All of the kids on that set were lovely. They worked very hard. It was interesting to play a woman who had left her children and her husband to pursue a career in Paris as a singer. It was not a sympathetic character, but I had to find something lovable about her to make her live. It was very touching. It was very touching to be a part of this series that had already been established. It was very touching to work with the late Bill Bixby, who was directing it, and everybody knew that he was very ill and wouldn't be with us long, but it was lovely. And it was hard work, because when you're not in front of an audience and you're trying to land an idea, it's hard to know if you did good or not. And it was also interesting to learn dialogue. You know, dialogue is sort of a distant cousin from singing. It's not really the same. So you're looking for different clues and sharing space with another actor. You're hoping that they're good and they're giving you enough juice to play with. Whereas singing, songs that I've been singing for so long do become living monologues. One of the things I teach, it's called The Art of Conversational Singing. It's not a very sexy title, but it's the truth. It's just, why would you be singing this song? Well, if you think of yourself in conversation with somebody where the first line of the song needs to happen, it makes the whole thing start to come alive, you know. But working with, once again, with Mayim, I mean, at 14, she could have just run the whole show. She wasn't pushy. She just was always incredibly and impeccably prepared. She had an incredible countenance about her. As a young kid, she was very joyful, but there was something very deep and wide in her spirit. And so the fact that she became a neuroscientist didn't really surprise me. She's just truly brilliant. And she happens to have this interesting gift as a comedian. You know, it's beautiful. I have written for Disney a couple of times. I first wrote a song for The Great Mouse Detective, which was very interesting.
Hey, fellas, the time is right. Get ready. Tonight's the night.
I mean, Disney was known for their exquisite animated films, Snow White, Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, and they all had fantastic songs come out of them. I don't know who was in charge of the period where they stopped putting songs in the animated films. Somebody thought that was a good idea. They thought, I don't know what they thought. So The Great Mouse Detective was going to reintroduce a song in the film. And I was the third writer brought in to try to write this, what they call a standalone song for this character, Kitty Mouse. She was a dance hall mouse, and she wasn't part of the plot. She was just entertaining all of these mice in a bar. And I met with the supervisor, music supervisor, and he was explaining to me what the scene was about. And I said to him, but this is family fair. You don't want me to write a stripper number like Let Me Entertain You. He said, no, it's family. So I submitted a song, and he sort of liked it, and he was hemming and hawing, and I finally interrupted him, and I said, would you like me to write Let Me Entertain You? And he said, yes, please. So I wrote a little strip song called Let Me Be Good to You, which my young cast members in Funny Girl loved because they had all seen the film. They grew up with the film. And then I wrote the score with the late Norman Gimbel for Lady and the Tramp 2. And that was just gorgeous because that was a real theater score. I mean, it was six songs and it was beautiful. I want to collaborate with Gaga. I think she's just remarkable. I always want to collaborate with Michael McDonald. I just think he is singular. And I would love to collaborate again with Bernie Taupin. I had the great privilege of working with him, and he's just on a whole other strata. Now that I'm finally away from Funny Girl, you know, I'm with my family and my grandkids and my friends. I cook a lot, I do laundry, I, you know, tend to mundane stuff because reestablishing your roots in your community is a major part of coming home off of a long tour. It took me a very long time to understand how my mind worked. Because talent is something other than your mind working. It's a sweet spot in your mind. But the actual how to talk with people, how to resolve issues, how to not only see a red flag, but stop trying to make it into a lovely red shawl, that took me a long time to learn. Understanding that life really takes courage, probably for everybody, but definitely to walk the artist's path. Because as an artist, you make a living by living your life. That's not easy, and I feel extremely fortunate that I've been able to do that. But it took me a very long time to really understand how my mind worked in terms of decision making, and that I needed a lot of help to understand that there were questions to be asked. There is a neutral act of gathering information, and to stop assigning shame to that. I'm not sure if that's gender specific, but I just was not taught any of this in my house. It was a very loving house, you know, very supportive house. I just never saw examples of how to talk to the point of resolution. I never saw in business how to talk in point, you know, to the point of resolution. I never was shown how to ask again, explain it to me again. Again, I still don't understand it. Explain it, use crayons. I still don't understand. Find a way to help me understand it. I just never saw that. And so, like many artists, I signed stupid contracts that I didn't understand or got into relationships with people that were just took too much help, and I thought my job was to help fix people. And when I finally saw that that was not within my boundary, you know, life started to make sense beyond just my talent. And so peace and serenity was mine to claim. But it took a long time. At last, I can speak about that with a little bit of authority and share that.
To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.